From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
The Strange Disappearance of John Harper. In a Midland town in the early 80s, there lived a Mr. and Mrs. Harper and their son, John. A cripple from his birth, John's case had been regarded as quite hopeless till just before his 19th birthday, when he suddenly showed signs of getting better. To everyone's surprise, he was not only able to leave his bed, but to hobble about the house and garden. When not otherwise occupied, he would sit on the lawn in front of the house, watching the passerbys. Sometimes a pretty face would attract his attention, for John was an extraordinary mixture of the materialist and the idealist. Then one morning he received a letter from his friends, the Browns at Quintox, a village 20 miles distant from his own, inviting him to spend the day with them. John was quite overcome with joy. After being looked upon as a hopeless invalid all his life, to be asked by his friends to spend the day with them, just as they would ask a normal boy, was to him a wonderful thing. His parents, when he told them, did not know what to say. With the aid of a crutch, it was true, the boy could hobble about the grounds, but he had never walked further than the pillar box. To get to Quintox, he would have to walk to the railway station a distance of a quarter of a mile. John's father did not like the idea of John going alone on his journey. He thought he should have someone to look after him. John, however, would not hear of it. He was 19, he said, and quite capable of taking care of himself, even if he was rather lame. He had his way in the end. The eventful day arrived. It was a perfect summer morning. The air fragrant with the scent of flowers, a cloudless blue sky, and a glorious sun. The entire household watched John depart. His father accompanied him to the station and helped him to get a seat in the train. At 5:30 that same day, his father and mother set off to the station in plenty of time to meet the train by which he was to return. They waited impatiently on the platform for the signal to fall, and when it fell and the train rounded the curve, known locally as the Elbow, their agitation and excitement was extreme. After what seemed to them an eternity, the train at last reached the platform and halted. They peered eagerly into carriage after carriage, hoping to see John. To their great dismay, he was not in the train. The Harpers were almost out of their mind. They anticipated the worst. The station master, anxious to allay their fears, wired at once to the station master at Quintox, asking him to send someone to Mr. Brown's to find out why young Mr. Harper hadn't returned. When the reply came, it proved a veritable thunderbolt. John was not at the Browns, and he hadn't been there. "We expected him by the first train in the morning," they wired, "but he didn't come. What has happened?" "Good God, what can have happened?" Mr. Harper ejaculated. "What can we do?" "Very possibly he forgot to get out of the train at Quintox and was taken on to Birmingham," the station master remarked. "But he's not at all forgetful, and it was to Quintox that he was so bent on going," Mr. Harper replied. "Besides, even if he had gone on to Birmingham by mistake, surely he would have taken the first train he could catch back and have arrived at the Browns later on in the day." In a state bordering on distraction, Mr. Harper took the train to Quintox and, arriving there, questioned the station officials, but none of them could give him any definite information. The porter, who took the tickets from the passengers as they left the platform, said he thought a lame gentleman was among those who had arrived by the train in question, but he couldn't be sure. More people than usual seemed to have come by that train, and as they passed out of the station altogether, he had not noticed anyone in particular. Mr. Harper then hastened to the Browns. From them he learned that they did not get to the station to meet John till 5 minutes after the train he was to come by had left. If he had come, they argued, He would surely either have started off to walk to their house, in which case they would have met him on the road, or waited for them. They were almost as upset as Mr. Harper himself, remarking that possibly John had gone to the fair. They suggested searching for him there. A thorough search of all the booths and the grandstand proved fruitless. At last, wearied and dispirited, they left the place. On wending their way to the station, some children came running after them. "Are you looking for a lame old gentleman?" they asked. "Not a lame old gentleman," Mr. Harper replied impatiently. "A lame young gentleman." "Well, we don't know what age he really was," a girl said, "but he seemed old compared with us. He stopped us outside the station this morning as we were going home from school and inquired the way to some house." "Was it the Lindens?" Mr. Brown asked eagerly. "The Lindens was the name of his house." But none of the children could remember. "He went on," they said, "along the lane leading to the old canal." Asked to describe him, one girl thought he was very fair, with a slight mustache, a description that fitted John, while another girl was of the opinion that he was dark and clean-shaven. The search party steered for the canal. The sun by this time had sunk low, and the sky was dark and lowering. A silence that harmonized well with the shadows of the tall, motionless trees that skirted the lane hung over the searchers as they walked. They seldom spoke. The scenery surrounding the canal was drear and depressing. The stone wall of the abandoned lock was moldering and covered with weeds. Close to the lock was a derelict cabin. "This is a nasty place," Mr. Harper exclaimed, as he bent down and peered into the dark, sullen water. "One can imagine anything horrible happening here." At that moment, there was a loud, wailing cry which seemed to come from the canal. It startled the searchers. Mr. Harper shivered. To him, there was something ominous in the cry. They searched around for John until the morning when, utterly exhausted and dispirited, they were obliged to give up hunting and to return home. The police dragged the canal and searched the whole neighborhood, but could discover no trace of John, and to this day his fate has remained a complete mystery. The Harpers always believed that John was murdered and that his body was thrown into the canal, where it became embedded in the mud and weeds out of reach of the dragnets of the police. The Mystery of Lydia Attlee. One beautiful evening in July 1850, John Hill, inhabitant of the little village of Ringstead, Northamptonshire, felt inspired to go for an after-supper stroll. The truth of the matter was he had eaten somewhat heartily and thought a turn in the open air before retiring to bed might ward off a nightmare. The clouds that had hung low in the sky all the afternoon had gradually cleared away, and now there was no trace of them, only an ultramarine sky, star-spangled and moonlit. John Hill had crossed one large field, sweet with the scent of clover and new-mown hay, and was close to the stile leading into a narrow, winding lane, when he was arrested by the sound of footsteps and voices that came to him with singular clearness amid the general silence of his surroundings. Villagers are not infrequently curious, and Hill was no exception. Creeping to the hedge, overhanging the lane, he cautiously peeped over and saw two people approaching him, the moonlight pouring on them threw their faces into strong relief, and he recognized one as Lydia Attlee, the pretty 19-year-old daughter of a Ringstead laborer, and the other as Weekly Ball, a well-to-do Ringstead tradesman. Ball being a married man with considerable pretensions to being respectable, his appearance at this time of the day in such a spot with a girl who had a reputation for being just a little giddy, not unnaturally excited Hill's interest. He noticed Lydia looked very haggard and agitated, and Ball sullen. Just as they passed him by, he heard Lydia remark, "I won't, Weekly Ball, I won't do or say anything of the kind. It's yours, yours, I tell you, and no one else's." Ball mumbled out something Hill could not catch in reply. They went on down the lane in the direction of the lonely orchard belonging to Weekly Ball, and finally Hill lost sight of them. About half an hour later, another inhabitant of Ringstead, Joseph Groom, was passing by the orchard when he heard voices. He at once stopped to listen. A girl was speaking, and he felt sure it was Lydia Attlee, whom he knew well. "I did not intend coming in here with you tonight, Weekly Ball," she said, "for I've got the feeling you intend killing me. Isn't it so?" Anxious to hear what the reply would be and who made it, Groom listened very eagerly. but he couldn't catch the slightest sound. There was an emphatic silence, broken at last by the woman saying, "The Lord have mercy on me, if I am to die in my present state of sin." The last sentence sounded very feeble, as if the speaker was getting more and more exhausted. Had Groom only entered the orchard at this juncture, and surely he had good excuse for so doing, one of the greatest of all Northamptonshire mysteries might have been nipped in the bud. But perhaps out of mere selfishness, or shall we say just cowardice, he refrained and set off home at once. The following day, Ringstead learned Lydia Atlee was missing from her home. She had failed to return at night, and her parents had not the slightest idea of her whereabouts. The local police were notified, and suspicion falling on Weekly Ball as a result of the tales told by John Hill and Joseph Groom respectively, his orchard was searched, not perhaps with the greatest thoroughness. At all events, no trace of her could be found. An anonymous letter was received by a local magistrate stating she had been seen since her reported disappearance by the writer of the letter in Gold Street, Northampton. Little value, however, was attached to the letter, the magistrates and the police believing it to be a hoax. It was thought that Weekly Ball knew more of the matter than he cared to disclose. He admitted meeting Lydia the night of her disappearance and escorting her as far as the orchard, where he declared they parted. He said he had kept company with her, and fearing that fact would come to the knowledge of his wife, had given her money on condition she left the village and never communicated with him again. Against this was a story told by Groom, but as nobody could be found, nothing was done, and the affair was let drop. Years passed, and then suddenly interest in it was revived. Digging in a ditch in the lane leading from Denver to Keystone one morning in the winter of 1864, a laborer came upon an entire skeleton, which the doctor, who was summoned, pronounced to be that of a woman between 16 and 20 years of age. The ditch being close to the orchard that had at one time belonged to Weekly Ball, the disappearance of Lydia Atlee was at once recalled to mind. A tooth in the left side of the jaw of the skull was missing, and a local man named Dix, declaring he had drawn a corresponding tooth from Lydia's mouth about a fortnight before she disappeared, the suspicion that it was her skeleton substantially increased. Once again, the local police took up the case, and as a result, Weekly Ball, who was now living in Northumberland, was arrested. He was brought before the Thrapston magistrates on the charge of murdering Lydia Atlee. It was urged by the prosecution that Ball had a very good reason for wanting Lydia out of the way. He had got her into trouble and was fearful of his wife finding out, also for his reputation in the village. It was the same old story that had figured so often in the annals of crime, and which, in all probability, will figure in them just as often again, for human nature, especially the dark and cruel side of it, unhappily never changes. Hill and Groom told their respective tales in court, as did the man who had drawn Lydia's tooth and the doctor who had examined the remains. The evidence against Ball, though circumstantial, was undoubtedly strong. The defense proved the spot where the skeleton had been found had long been used by the gypsies as an unhallowed cemetery for their dead, and Ball argued that the skeleton found there was that of a gypsy and not of Lydia Atlee. He left the court a free man. For a long time after the disappearance of Lydia Atlee, which was fully reported in the contemporary Northamptonshire journals, people declared that when they were walking or driving along the Denver to Keystone Lane at night, they saw a girl who was closely resembled Lydia Atlee. She was looking ghastly pale and agitated. She always disappeared very suddenly and mysteriously at the spot where the skeleton was found. People also said that when they were passing a deep pool not far from Weekly Ball's orchard, they heard dreadful cries and saw eerie lights. The lane and the pool acquired such ghostly reputations that no one liked to venture near them alone after nightfall. The Riddle of the Skeleton. One cold winter's evening in the 30s of the last century, a young girl sat knitting by the bedside of an aged woman. Outside, the wind raged furiously, howling down the chimney. Every now and again, when the noises was at its highest pitch, the old woman would sigh and moan and begin to say her prayers, and whenever there was a temporary lull, she would leave off and lie absolutely still. This state of things had gone on for some hours, and it was fast approaching midnight, when quite suddenly the old beldame raised a white and skinny hand and beckoned to the girl. "Liza," she whispered, "I feel I shan't live till morning. The wind in the chimney tells me so. 'Tis no ordinary storm. Fetch Samuel, I have something I want to tell you both." Liza rose, and hastening up the rickety flight of wooden steps that led to the little room above, prepared to awake Samuel. To her relief, however, he was not asleep, and on hearing what her mission was, he at once got up and accompanied her downstairs. Directly they were both in the room, seated close to her, the old woman began. "It was one morning 30 years ago. I forget the day of the month. I never could remember dates. I only recollect it was in the winter, an icy day like this. I was housekeeper then to William Smith. He used to live at the farm just outside this village on the road to Oakham." Samuel nodded. "Well, in those days," the old woman went on, "I weren't so bad looking. At least, William Smith didn't think so, and... But there, I may as well tell you, for 'tis all part and parcel of my confession. Your mother was his child, our child. Listen, it was a bad, wild day like this 30 years ago. I tell you that I was sitting in the parlor of the farm, cutting out a dress from some expensive material William Smith had brought me a day or two before from London. William suddenly entered the room. I could see at once by his face that something was wrong, and he told me that he was very pressed for money. Certain speculations he had been indulging in lately had failed. He was in debt, and unless he could meet certain of his creditors immediately, he would very likely have to go to prison. We talked it over," the old woman went on, "and I suggested all sorts of things, none of which struck William as at all practical. Well, he said at length, there is only one hope as far as I can see, and that lies in Ben Jonson." "Who's he?" I asked. "Why, the beast jobber from Fryston," William replied, "the fellow from whom I bought those 20 cattle the week before last. He is coming here today for the money which I promised him 10 days ago. Jonson has heaps of money, and maybe if both of us, for you must help me, mind, tried very hard, we could persuade him not only to give us a little longer to pay him, but also lend us a little. It is our one chance. It is either that or jail. I promised William I would do my best with Johnson, but when Johnson came, my heart sank, for I saw there was little or no hope as far as he was concerned. He was a big, florid-faced individual with ugly, projecting teeth, a coarse, impudent, leering mouth, and very furtive, ferrety eyes. 'Well, Mr. Smith,' he began the moment he entered the house, 'I've come after that money, £200, and I don't leave this house till I get it.' Well, William called me, and we both begged and implored, but it was of no avail. Thinking a glass or two of wine, real port, 50 years old at least, which William's uncle had left him along with a few other things, might appease him, we plied him with it, but it made no difference. He drank it glass after glass, but he still demanded the money, and using the most dreadful language, swore he would get it or see us both hanged." Here the old woman once again paused, and the two listeners could hear the storm roaring and raging with greater violence than ever round the cottage. Presently she began talking again. "It was I that first thought of it," she croaked. "To be turned out of doors, into the roads and lanes, with nowhere to rest, it was impossible. Anything was better than that. To save time and enable me to ransack my brains and think, I plied him with more and more port. And when he wasn't looking, I fetched a sleeping draught, which old Mother Carey had given me. He never saw me slip it in, and he drank it all. He was soon lolling back in his chair, fast asleep, with a fat yellow leather wallet bulging out of his vest pocket. Directly I saw that wallet, a hideous thought flashed through my mind. Why not kill Johnson? I had no sooner conceived the idea than I whispered it to Smith. To do Smith justice, he was overwhelmed with horror at first, and it was only after I had explained to him that it was really the only way to save both of us from ruin that he eventually yielded. We then stripped Johnson of all the valuables he had on him, and popping him, still sleeping, into a sack, carried him between us to an empty, isolated cottage 200 or 300 yards from the farm. When we arrived, there we laid him on the floor, and after making sure no one was looking, we proceeded to carry out our terrible design. Unfortunately, the jogging and jarring on the road had awakened him, and he was beginning to struggle violently to free himself from the sack. I knelt on him, and pressing his head down with all my might, bade William do the rest. We weighted the sack with stones and carried it to the River Given, which was only a few yards distant, and dropped it in the water. Oh, that river I shall never forget. It has haunted me day and night. It looked so dark and deep and flowed so swiftly, swollen with several days of rain. It had always been haunted. I never saw the ghost, but William did. A headless woman in a white dress. After we had disposed of the body, we went back to the cottage and cleared away, as best we could, all traces of what we had done. The money we had obtained enabled William to pay off several of his worst debts, and we remained in the farm for some years. We could never get the murder out of our minds, and were constantly tormented with visions of Ben Jonson struggling to get out of the sack. We never went near the old cottage or the river after dusk if we could help. The old woman paused with the exhaustion of talking and sank back on her pillow. Suddenly she cried, "Quick, quick! Give me your hands. The river, the sack, the sack! Hold me fast. Don't let go of me. I'm dying. I dare not go alone." And she expired. Samuel and Liza reported her confession to the local clergyman, and there was a report of it in the Lincolnshire Press. A schoolmaster named Hinds saw it and at once associated it with his cousin Benjamin Johnson, who had been last seen alive in 1801. Johnson had been a cattle jobber, and on the morning of December 24 had set out from a place near Oakham with a stranger in the neighborhood known as Bailey, with the avowed intention of visiting William Smith, a farmer who owed him a considerable sum of money. When they were about halfway, they met a farmer named Hackett. This farmer testified to having paid Johnson several hundreds of pounds, and he declared that after the completion of the transaction, he had sent Johnson and Bailey set off together down a lane leading direct to Smith's farm. When Smith was asked if Johnson had visited him, he said the only person who had called at his farm on the day in question had been one of his old friends, a man named Jones, who had gone abroad where he did not know. The river maintained its grim secret. The sack with the body was never found. The Featureless Horror. My great-grandmother, Elizabeth Falk of Almsthorpe, like some of her forebears and descendants, was keenly interested in the supernatural. Her father, John Falk, who was descended through his ancestors, Edward Shuckburgh of Naseby and Sir Thomas Halford, from William of Wickham, Lord High Chancellor of England and founder of New College, Oxford, and Winchester College, had a private museum of valuable coins and curios. In his collection was a glass bottle containing a number of curious figures, with a head of an ecclesiastic for stopper. The bottle, which was between 300 and 400 years old, was regarded as a talisman and a protection against evil spirits. It was bequeathed to Elizabeth and is now mine. Elizabeth had several ghostly experiences, and the following is one of them. On one occasion, she was driving with her father along a little frequented road between Leicester and Lutterworth. It was getting dusk, and they had come to a gloomy hollow when their horse came to an abrupt halt, indicating signs of fear. John Falk, at a loss to understand the animal's unusual behavior, plied his whip, but without avail. Determined to ascertain the cause of the horse's fright, Elizabeth alighted while her father remained seated holding the reins. She was no sooner on the ground when she heard a curious sound close beside her. She looked quickly around her and saw a tall, hooded figure in black come through the wayside hedge and cross the road towards a solitary tree. When it reached the tree, it turned slowly round, threw back its hood, and revealed a gleaming white face, which appeared to be entirely devoid of features. Where they should have been was just a blank. Elizabeth was terror-stricken and felt on the verge of fainting when her father, whose attention had been concentrated on the horse, called to her. Directly he spoke, The apparition vanished. Elizabeth scrambled into the carriage and was hardly seated when the horse, having recovered from its fright, spurted forward and bore them without a halt to their destination. They subsequently learned that the tree under which the hooded phantom had stood and vanished had been reputed to be haunted for very many years. There was nothing so far as was known to account for the haunting. My great-grandmother sustained no ill effects from her ghostly experience, a fact she attributed to the protecting influence of the glass bottle, which she always kept on a table by her bedside, and treated with the greatest reverence and affection.